You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. The issuance of arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former war minister Yoav Gallant last November 21st descended like a lightning bolt on the two, neither of whom figured they'd ever face justice for crimes they vehemently deny. Equally shaken up, some ready and willing to fulfill their duty to the world's top criminal court, others hedging their bets, were the 125 state parties to their own statute of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, now tasked with executing arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant should either of them land in their territories. Early last December, at the World Forum Convention Center in The Hague, state parties to the International Criminal Court gathered for the 23rd session of the ICC's Assembly of State Parties, the representative body that governs the implementation of the ICC's founding treaty, the 2002 Rome Statute. Among the crimes Netanyahu and Gallant have been charged with in warrants classified secret, the war crime of starvation as a method of warfare, and the crimes against humanity of murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts, all part of a widespread and systematic attack against the civilian population of Gaza. The GPM sat down with Vusi Madonsela, South Africa's ambassador to the Netherlands and delegate to the ICC's Assembly of State Parties. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, this is an exciting but an exhausting exercise in discussion, listening, consulting. It's a kind of an obvious question, but why are you at this gathering of the Assembly of State Parties? What does the Assembly of State Parties offer that is distinct from, say, the International Court of Justice and those halls? Because what goes on here is really quite distinct from what goes on at the International Court of Justice, isn't it? There you're talking to 15 justices, and here you're speaking with, you know, representatives from 125 different countries about matters that really interest you, Palestine, for instance.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you. The appearing before the International Court of Justice is something different from being at the Assembly of States Parties, because being before the court is essentially a process of litigation where you're addressing the court on specific matters about which you are inviting the court to make a decision. It is a court of the United Nations which has jurisdiction over a whole range of matters affecting members of the United Nations, whereas the Assembly of States Parties is a policy decision-making body of the International Criminal Court, which is established in terms of the Rome Statute. So being in the Assembly affords us the opportunity to cross-pollinate our ideas about what is the overall direction that the court needs to take in the contemporary circumstances. You would know that the court is currently confronted with big issues relating to the threats to it, and the court has got to be seized with how best it is going to respond to those threats, having acknowledged that they exist. And part of being here then is to harvest everybody's wisdom on how best the court needs to move forward, especially because I think the court has become such an important institution, perhaps the only institution which we believe should be able to exercise universal jurisdiction over the most serious crimes.
And I mean, the International Court of Justice has issued preliminary measures orders against Israel in South Africa's genocide case against Israel, like, well, originally, and then re-enunciated those provisional measures orders, I think, twice, subsequently three times. And the of course, it's going to take years for it to adjudicate that. And then it issued its advisory opinion, which was a landmark ruling. But I would venture to say that it's been largely ignored, the advisory opinion ruling. I mean, the General Assembly came out with a resolution, but nobody is, you know, the powers that be, the most powerful states in the world, are not holding Israel accountable. But here at the ICC, we imagine real accountability happening, right? Those arrest warrants, I think, carry, in a certain sense, far more weight and are far more consequential than even this landmark advisory opinion ruling. Would you agree or disagree or hedge that a bit?
I wouldn't agree with that assertion. First of all, it is true that the provisional measures that have been issued by the court have been ignored by the state of Israel. But beyond that, I think it's also important to understand that the court, the International Court of Justice, doesn't have its own means to enforce its own decisions. It depends on the United Nations Security Council to assist with the enforcement of its decisions. We all know what the state of the UN Security Council is at present, which perhaps fortifies the resolve by many countries that the UN system as a whole, in fact, requires review. Because even the veto system that attaches to permanent members of the UN Security Council have reached a point where, in fact, the exercise of that veto has become counterproductive to the purposes for which the UN actually exists and the purpose for which the UN Security Council in particular exists. So a complete overhaul of that system is going to be required. But coming back to the International Criminal Court. Yes, the warrants of arrests have been issued, but we are all fully aware of the fact that these warrants effectively become travel bans more than they actually become a real means by which the people against whom they have been issued will necessarily be arrested and brought to the court. I say this advisedly because we've listened to some statements being made by countries like France, the UK, we understand even the Netherlands may be dithering in that direction, that says that they think there is the technical loophole that would allow them not to cooperate with the court by way of arresting and surrendering Prime Minister Netanyahu or former Minister Gallant. People, instead of looking at how to assist the court, some states seem to be looking at how to avoid assisting the court. I'm referring to those countries specifically because they're the kind of countries that are likely to be visited by some of the people against whom those warrants have been issued, which effectively means that the purpose of the court and the purpose of the decision by the pretrial chamber to issue those warrants could easily be undermined by that. So,
and how likely do you think it is, Ambassador Madonsela, that the warrant will be thwarted here in Europe, perhaps even by like Canada? Of course, it will be thwarted by the United States.
Well, we understand that some states have not as yet made pronouncements about whether or not they would be able to effect an arrest. Others are a bit ambivalent about it. But we would hope that all states would be committed to the Rome Statute system and be prepared to fully comply with the court, regardless of what threats are being made to the court. In fact, you would have heard a number of ministers during the general debate who have made very strong statements expressing their support for the court and its officials and also defending the operations of the court, which is a strong message that we believe needs to come out of the Assembly of States Parties. But that means all states parties must be willing to put their shoulder to the wheel and cooperate with the court, or else the international criminal justice system is going to be undermined.
Have those arrest warrants actually been issued, sent out to states parties by the ICC's registry? Has South Africa received those warrants?
I have no direct knowledge of whether or not all states parties have received requests for cooperation. But I expect that by now, following the issuing of those warrants by the pretrial chamber of the International Criminal Court, that the Office of the Prosecutor, pursuant to that, would have issued requests for cooperation to states parties. But normally, these things are sometimes handled in a very confidential manner. So I'm not able to say whether or not South Africa has received any such requests, nor would I be able to tell you whether any other state has received.
Do you anticipate that charges of genocide will be added to Mr. Khan's charge list? There was some commentary that Khan's charges should have included genocide. Are genocide charges in store in your view, and should they be?
Well, in our referral, South Africa, joined by four other states, Bolivia, Djibouti, Bangladesh, and Comoros, we have specifically listed genocide as one of the crimes we had reason to believe were being committed. So,
That was your referral to the ICC?
To the International Criminal Court, that's correct. So far, the Office of the Prosecutor has not included that in the warrant of arrest. But we believe that the investigations are ongoing in any event. And in the event that the prosecutor has enough evidence to sustain a charge of genocide, nothing prevents them from including that charge, especially in the event that an arrest has been effected.
Last question. It's astonishing what the State of Israel has managed to get away with over the course of the last 14 months in Gaza. And, of course, its occupation of the Palestinian territories is now, 57 or 58 years old. And it's effectively colonized the West Bank. It's established hundreds of settlements with almost 750,000 settlers there in the territories in flagrant violation of international law and completely free to do so. And powerful states parties render aid and assistance to Israel and its effect of colonization endeavor. And so you look at this impunity and one wonders, how on earth is all this violence and destruction and injustice going to end if the rule of law is so completely and totally ignored by the most powerful countries in the world? And one looks to the ICC and the ICJ with a certain degree of hope. Thoughts on this?
Well, certainly, I think what we are seeing now are the consequences of an unequal world, wherein it depends on who your friends are. If you have powerful friends, you can get away with impunity. But that's the kind of world we don't want to live in. And that kind of world becomes even more possible once it becomes unipolar, which is why there are initiatives in other parts of the world in the form of BRICS calling for a multipolar world, which would create a balance. Because in a unipolar world, there is actually no balance at all. And those who are friends to the most powerful in that kind of world can get away with anything. And that's the kind of situation in which we find ourselves today. And we are saying that's the kind of world that is not desirable. Because in that world, there is no equality before the law. In that world, there is no rule in the international system that governs everybody on an equal basis. So we are advocating for an international system that is based on international law, and that everybody must be equal before that law.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Vusi Madonsela is the Republic of South Africa's ambassador to the Kingdom of the Netherlands, based in The Hague, and delegate to the International Criminal Court's Assembly of State Parties. We'll link to South Africa's court case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, charging Israel with genocide under the 1949 Genocide Convention, at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're checking that out, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Assault on Gaza, now into its 15th month, shows no sign of ending. Widely described as genocidal, Israel's campaign has been condemned by numerous human rights and international legal authorities, none more authoritative than the International Court of Justice. Last month, yet another United Nations body weighed in, the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The third committee was formed under the auspices of the 1966 International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, one of nine human rights treaties under the UN system, among the crimes prohibited under CERD, apartheid, 7 years prior to the 1973 Apartheid Convention. To date, 182 UN member states have ratified CERD. Under the terms of the CERD Treaty, a committee was formed to monitor its adherence. The committee is made up of 18 members, independent human rights experts drawn from around the world. CERD is unique among UN rights bodies. It's the only one that allows one state to lodge complaints against another, and for those complaints to be conciliated. Back in 2019, Palestine lodged one of those complaints against Israel, accusing Israel of apartheid. It took years for the CERD committee to deal with it. Israel refused to participate. Earlier this year, CERD released its conclusions on the failed conciliation process. Notwithstanding the mountain of evidence presented to it, the committee did not arrive at an explicit finding of apartheid. Another unusual mechanism at CERD's disposal, early warning and urgent action statements. This past December 13th, CERD issued one of these in response to the ongoing situation in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon. The committee declared itself appalled by the brutal, indiscriminate attacks on innocent women, children, and men, mainly in Gaza, the killing of more than 44,500 Palestinians, the injuries of more than 105,000, the near total and deliberate destruction of the homes, hospitals, and schools, displacement of about 1.9 million Gazans, the unprecedented levels of starvation in Gaza, the killing of at least 343 aid workers, including 253 UN staff, 1,047 health workers, and 183 journalists, raising serious concerns regarding the obligations of Israel and other state parties to prevent war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. With me to talk about CERD's early warning and urgent action statement is David Keane. Keane is an assistant professor in law at Dublin City University, Ireland. He has published a number of works on the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, ICERD. Hello, David Keane. Welcome back to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hello, David Kattenberg. Thank you for having me.
David, what is it that fascinates you about ICERD, the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, and the work of the CERD Committee? How is it that you got involved in specializing in looking at CERD and its work? And what makes that work so interesting to you?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I think a little bit from your introduction there, I think it has some unusual mechanisms, as you pointed out. I think I would slightly correct you. You said it's the only one that does interstate complaints. It's not. It's the only one with a compulsory interstate complaints mechanism. There are others that have interstate complaints mechanisms as well, but it's the only one where it's compulsory, which became important in relation to Palestine and Israel also. I'd also point out that Israel didn't disengage with the whole of the interstate case. It only disengaged after the decisions on jurisdiction and admissibility went against it. So it did participate in the early part, not in the later ones. I think the treaty itself, it's the importance of its mandate in the elimination of racial discrimination. I think I felt that it's a very significant mandate. It has its origins in colonialism and apartheid in the 1960s. And I think the significance of what the treaty does has really come through not only in this context, but in more recent years, although I know the discussion today is on Palestine or situation in Gaza and Palestine versus Israel. But I think we see the significance of CERD being raised or being litigated before the International Court of Justice, for example, in the Armenia and Azerbaijan cases, which are currently before the International Court of Justice as well. So I think the importance of its mandate, but also I think the sort of the innovative nature as well of some of its mechanisms, like the compulsory interstate mechanism and like the early warning and urgent action mechanism as well, which you've mentioned in your introduction also.
And I'd like to ask you, David, to comment about this early warning statement that's just been released, early warning and urgent action procedures statement, or statement under this procedural element. And if I'm not mistaken, it's now the second one that CERD has released in response to the situation in occupied Palestine. So I want to ask you about this particular statement just released last week, which is pretty damning. But before we do, I want to ask you about the results of CERD's conciliation process, which concluded in August, and it took like years for all this to culminate, for CERD to investigate it and then to launch into conciliation, which Israel refused to participate in. And we were all poised, I mean, people who are watching this were poised to see if CERD would come out with what you refer to as an individuated charge of apartheid, because under the convention, both racial discrimination and apartheid, the two are separate, distinguished from each other. You know, would CERD come up with a finding of apartheid as opposed to simply, garden variety racial discrimination, however systematic that may be? And in the end, it didn't come up with a finding of apartheid. And you were a bit surprised, because this was like in the wake of the International Court of Justice's ruling, which didn't really make a statement of apartheid either, but the ICJ kind of really alluded to apartheid. But, CERD didn't get into that.
Yeah. I wouldn't call it kind of garden variety of racial discrimination, I think. But first of all, it's... In relation to CERD, the principal provision is Article 3, and Article 3 has two terms in it, racial segregation and apartheid. And I think what I'd been tracking a bit in Palestine versus Israel would come through also in the ICJ advisory opinion. So once the advisory opinion came out, I was pretty quick to point out that what the ICJ was saying, which was a violation of Article 3, was not necessarily a finding of apartheid. As I said very clearly in the context of the Palestine versus Israel case before CERD, CERD had also reached findings of violations of Article 3 in relation to Israel in the state reporting procedure. It had done it a few times, but had not been clear that that meant apartheid. So Article 3 states parties particularly condemn racial segregation and apartheid and undertake to prevent, prohibit and eradicate all practices of this nature in territories under their jurisdiction. That's what Article 3 says. It is the first international treaty prohibition of apartheid. It's a hugely significant provision. But it has two terms in it, racial segregation and apartheid. If you go back to the drafting history, racial segregation is in there because of practices of apartheid, but also practices in the United States, for example. And so it's not a violation of Article 3 is not automatically a finding of apartheid. So I pointed this out, and that's really what I also argued the Palestine versus Israel case, which was about many things, but that was certainly one of the central threads, if not the most important argument in it, which was that CERD had reached a decision that violations of Article 3 were occurring, but had not, as the word I've used, which comes from also Patrick Thornbury's used it, the individuated apartheid, taking that one word out and sort of in addition to racial segregation. So we didn't have, that's what Palestine versus Israel was litigating, really, I think, or at least partly. It was, we know it was being litigated because Palestine's interstate communication, the complaint that went before the committee, had 30 pages about apartheid, about an individuated finding of apartheid as distinct from racial segregation. So,
and why would CERD, I mean, who knows, right? But why do you think CERD would not go there in spite of the almost overwhelming evidence?
Yeah, I mean, the mechanism is one of conciliation, so which is something which is found in a few treaties early on and not in others. So what exactly conciliation means had never been tested before. This is the very first interstate case ever before a UN treaty body. So I think the Conciliation Commission spent a lot of time, as I argue, too much time on the conciliation role, and then did not perhaps look in sufficient detail at the complaint role. I've published on this a blog piece that the decision was underwhelming and disappointing on that aspect in particular. I felt that they had been, that's what the complaint was, that they were asked to investigate from a legal perspective whether a situation of apartheid had arisen in the occupied Palestinian territory. That's there in 30 pages of Palestine's complaint. Now, you can agree or disagree with a finding or a result, but what I was critical of was that they didn't investigate the question. So they didn't look at Palestine's claim, which was to make a legal finding in relation to apartheid. So Palestine urged an objective, clear and legal description of the principal elements and characteristics of apartheid and against which to measure the question and whether Israel applies and conclude whether Israel applies apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territory. Now, CERD doesn't have a definition of apartheid, so you need a definition, you need an understanding. There is a definition in the Apartheid Convention, which came later. There's a definition in the Rome Statute, which came later. The International Court of Justice would debate this. Some of the individual opinions there would discuss the meaning of apartheid, its definitions. CERD had an opportunity, or the Ad Hoc Conciliation Commission had an opportunity to engage with the legal meaning of apartheid and then to decide whether a situation of apartheid exists or not. It didn't do that. It just didn't investigate that at all. So I think in that regard, the decision can only be considered disappointing and not sort of engaging with what was put before it.
I mean, do you have a sense of why they didn't address the substantive question?
I don't know why. And they haven't said why. So I wasn't privy to the, I know they spent, I mean, if you read the report, they did spend a lot of time trying to conciliate. So again, I said that was right. Their role was to conciliate. They did engage repeatedly with Israel and try to get Israel to engage, involve in the procedure, in the conciliation procedure. They tried to figure, I think some, they approached potential litigators amongst others. They even suggested to Israel that they could go visit Israel as well. And again, I said that was good that they tried to, or they took their conciliation role seriously. But then when Palestine offered for them to come and visit and see the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, they seemed to ignore that request as well. So